Was there any fraud in the 2020 election?
I would say it really depends on how we're going to define fraud. One of the things we know happened is digital ads were run that misled voters. We saw ads that, you know, told people that if they used mail-in balloting, that their votes wouldn't be counted. We saw ads that told people, you know, things about the candidates that weren't true. We saw a wide range of issues within political ads. And, you know, if we're going to say that's election fraud, then yeah, that happened. If we're going to say, was there election fraud in terms of ballot box stuffing, then no, that did not happen.
So let's start out. There weren't bamboo ballots from China filled out by Joe Biden or for Joe Biden. Is that correct?
Right.
We don't want to legitimize the big lie about voter fraud that has been used to deny and curtail voting rights around the country. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely.
That said, we do want to talk about the integrity of our elections. In the past, we've talked about the outsized impact of money on those elections. One of the ways that money distorts democracy is deciding what messages get seen by which voters. With the micro-targeting of voters made possible by social media and new technology, not as new as it used to be, that can have a distorting impact, and that distorting impact is put into pretty important focus. Someone, of course, needs to be keeping an eye on political advertising. And if not, of course, maybe you haven't thought about it before, let me say, someone needs to be keeping an eye on political advertising and advocate for regulations, for rules, to make sure that there isn't misinformation dominating the conversation. Today, we have a chance to talk to that very someone, Laura Edelson, Director of Cybersecurity and Democracy, based out of NYU, New York University. Laura, thank you for joining us and welcome to Democracy Nerd.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. Cybersecurity and democracy, what is it?
Yeah, so we are a project based out of NYU. Specifically, we are cybersecurity experts and computer scientists. And our goal is to be a nonpartisan research-based effort to understand online threats to democracy. We see this problem through a cybersecurity lens, and we look for those kinds of solutions. We try to attack the data problem and the data organization problem from that technical perspective.
What does victory for you look like?
I would say the effect that we are trying to achieve is one where people look at Facebook, they look at digital advertising on Google and YouTube, and they don't get this like well of fear in their chest because they think it's a disaster and tearing down our society. I think that when we get to that point, we will have done our jobs.
What are the biggest threats to democracy right now in your mind? If you can narrow it to one, I'll take one. But if you can't narrow it to one, I'll take more.
So I think we really are experiencing a crisis of trust and of faith in our systems and the actors within them. And there's a lot of ways that this problem goes beyond the online space, right? If we have major political actors like the former president telling people that they cannot trust the voting process, they cannot trust their local election officials, that's obviously a huge problem that goes beyond the digital space. But a big part of this trust issue is the fact that there are a huge number of voices in online spaces that have a lot of credibility that people spend a lot of time in, like YouTube and Facebook. And there are voices in those spaces that are just telling people lies, and they are telling people that they can't trust the system as a whole. And I think that's where, you know, I think we do need to step in. We need to develop better systems, and the technical community needs to step up.
How long have you been doing this?
How long have I been doing political ads?
Yeah.
I've been working in the political ad space since 2018, since the first digital archives became available. I've been working on problems of big data and applying machine learning for, I don't know, 15 years or so.
What were inflection points in your understanding of the problem that we're up against?
So they've been around our elections. So these archives first became available in 2018. And I will fully admit that particularly the first few months that I worked on this problem going into the 2018 midterms, I really thought, you know, hey, you know, this is a lot of data. I know how to deal with a lot of data. We are going to build systems to make this data more understandable. We're going to build some models to identify misinformation, you know, and we're going to knock this out in a couple of years. And I think what I really saw in the 2018 election is the problem is much more complicated than that. And it really is a true cybersecurity problem in the sense that we are not just dealing with honest actors who are making mistakes. There are adversaries who are legitimately trying to mislead people. And we also have a problem of misaligned incentives where I don't think that Facebook or Google or anyone else want to run misinformation. But I think that for a lot of these ad platforms, the costs that they have to bear, not just in terms of how expensive it would be to build good detection algorithms, but the changes that it would require to their systems as a whole, they are changes that they're just not going to make absent probably new regulation. And that combination of things means that this isn't just something that is a technical problem. This is a policy problem. This is a society problem. And that's why I think we need to develop bigger solutions.
So that brings us maybe then to the theory of change that you have or that your organization has. How do you think about how you will sort of make a change in this sphere?
So we are computer scientists. And, you know, while we can make policy recommendations, we really see our role as making sure that the public is as well informed as possible, that journalists are well informed, that policymakers are well informed about what's actually going on online. And I think that when we do that, when we do our jobs well, people who do think about what we are going to need to do to develop healthier, you know, levels of trust in our society and the political process, they can do their jobs to call for change. And, you know, I think we're already seeing this work in certain ways. We were involved in, you know, very early on in 2018, pointing out how some of these early iterations of the political ad archives and the disclosure to users just weren't working. And that has already prompted change. So when we put out a report in 2018 and 19 that talked about how the disclosure strings to users were just were bad. They did not work well. It did prompt the platforms to change how those user disclosures were built. Now we are involved in some of the calls to make more ad data transparent because we've been able to show that advertisers are evading the platform's efforts at enforcement. And again, like I think that we are seeing change, but you know, we just try to make the data available and help people make better decisions.
So I put up, I think this is from your website, a graphic because of the handy setup. People can actually see it if you're doing the video version of the show. Walk us through, I think you may have it memorized. You also might be able to see it on the screen here. Walk us through this flow chart here, and we'll try to give enough of an explanation that it isn't required for people to be able to see it for our, you know, audio listeners.
I know this like the back of my hand. So
I know the back of my hand not all that well. Like if somebody asked me to describe it, I don't know. I would describe it very much like I would describe anybody else's hand. But go on. That's another topic. That's for hand nerds.
So on a very simple level, the first thing we do is we collect a lot of data. We don't just collect data about a few campaigns or a few issues. We collect basically the entire Facebook ad library and the entire Google political ad library, collect all of it. We run all of that whole thing through our analysis pipeline, and then we try to present more usable interfaces to that data than the platforms themselves provide. We provide some public tools like Ad Observatory, and a crucial part of that, you know, data collection to presentation pipeline, we actually have a browser extension called Ad Observer that people who use Facebook or YouTube can download. And when they use that, they'll send us their observations of ads that are shown to them. We sort of smush all that data together. We present data through Ad Observatory. We have some private tools that we give to partners at civil society organizations. And we also just write reports and do research on those results. Then we try to make sure that the high level learnings of all of those things make it to journalists like you, to policymakers. So we absolutely consult on legislation, issues like that. We consult on regulation and how regulations can be implemented. And we think that generally speaking, everyone knows that changes to regulation of ad platforms and to social media platforms as a whole is coming. And what we're trying to do is make sure that people who are going to be shaping that policy have the best research that we can provide so that when that change happens, that it's the best it can be. And we think that that does drive changes to platform behavior, which again, helps us collect more and better data and helps us, refine the process all over again.
When you're at lunch, you're trying to describe to people what you do and they prod a little bit and you're wanting to, or trying to tell your parents or your friends about the sort of impact you're having, you're going to your, graduate school reunion or whatever. How do you tell that story? Or maybe what's a garden variety, or if not garden variety, your favorite example of that impact you're having?
Oh, I've got a good one. So you know what? The 2020 election had a lot of bad ads, but there's a couple of examples that I think we really were able to both move the needle in the short term and we're leading to lasting change. So Facebook, I think as everyone knows, has a policy that you are not allowed to lie in political ads unless you are the candidate. Candidates are allowed to lie, but nobody else is.
It's a fantastic rule.
That's the policy.
Right, I understand. There's something there, right, where the politician is allowed to lie and nobody else should, but go on.
That I can't speak to, but that is the policy. So one of the things that we found is that the way this policy was actually being implemented in fact is that if, let's say, a fact checker or a user reported, hey, there's a claim in this ad that is false. Here's the fact check, it's false. Facebook would take down that one ad. But if there was another 100 copies of that ad, those other 100 copies of the ad would not be taken down. And this is a very obvious problem with just enforcement, right? This isn't that the policy is bad. You may quibble about the policy, but they're not even forcing that policy. We were able to identify
like my cousin, in terms of copies, like my cousins who didn't finish high school or college know how to copy, a Facebook ad, and I've seen them.
Right. And this is actually, this isn't even, so advertisers themselves do this. Advertisers themselves will run dozens or even hundreds or thousands of different instances of the same identical ad creative, but maybe they're targeting it to a slightly different audience, or they're running it on a different day or a different platform. So this is a very normal thing that advertisers will do. Well, they'll run one ad creative in, again, like hundreds of different ads. And if Facebook is only pulling down a single copy, it's just not a very effective.
Let's make sure I understand
this. This is what happened.
So give me an example. Okay. Yeah. No, give your example and then I'll save my confusion for the end.
Well, so what happened was we identified this problem. We told Facebook about it. Nothing happened. But what actually got something done is the Wall Street Journal ran a story about this problem. And that got something done in the short term, where in the short term, we with the Wall Street Journal identified hundreds of ads that had millions of impressions of ads with false claims that where it was a false claim that had already been reported and already been actioned, but Facebook just hadn't taken down many, many copies of these ads. And after that Wall Street Journal article came out, it got better in the short term where all those other copies of the ads got pulled down. And we know that Facebook has begun actioning ads with false claims by the ad creative and not just the single ad. So we have actually been able to move the needle at the platforms by making it really public that this problem exists.
At least the biggest platforms still care about what a legacy journalist outfit has to say.
Yeah, I think they do. Because yeah. I think, among other things, the platforms know that they're not popular. They know that they have a trust problem. Mm-hmm. And all these kinds of issues, really, they are not making that better.
This is the sort of leftward, or I guess on my screen, rightward messenger circle on your theory of change, where it goes collecting the data, then analyzing that data, developing topic models and other analysis techniques, and then use open data sets and tools, publish those tools to inform messengers. And the messengers, like the Wall Street Journal, like other folks, like researchers, like civic organizations, other journalists, can then maybe impact policymakers. Policymakers, in this case, were the platforms themselves. And now I sort of see what you hope to be a benevolent cycle.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. You know, I think we are driving toward a future with regulatory change, but right now we are still in the self-regulation zone. So that's where we try to play.
And I don't know if this stays just in self-regulation or if this starts moving into regulation above, but or from above, but you co-wrote a call for universal digital ad transparency. Tell that story. What was the universal digital ad transparency, or what is that call?
Yeah, so this came out of the frustration that I and a lot of other researchers have with the way that ad transparency is developing. You know, we're glad that the voluntary efforts are happening. They are better than nothing, but they really leave a lot to be desired. And more importantly, they're very piecemeal. You know, Google has a very narrow definition of what they think is political and therefore what they make public. Facebook makes no targeting data available, and it's like the actual use of their ad library API is very, very technically difficult. Every platform seems to have a different standard of what they include. This is just not going to work going forward. And there's this other really big elephant in the room, which is, as much as political ads get a lot of the attention, they're just not the only really serious problem in online digital ads. There is a really bad problem with employment, housing, and credit ads, those ads being either deceptive or discriminatory. There's another big problem, employment ads that mislead job hunters. So I think we really are at the point where we need universal ad transparency. And I think a lot of people at this point think that.
At what point does this need to move beyond and say more about the path to moving beyond self-regulation, moving beyond like asking the bank shot of the Wall Street Journal to Mark Zuckerberg to say, hey, let's do something about this, because right now, you know, our Facebook poll numbers are low, and actually get the Leviathan of federal regulation to address it?
There are quite a few legislative efforts in the works, both in the US and Europe. The big ones worth talking about would probably be, you know, the Honest Ads Act that has a lot of support. Facebook says that they support the Honest Ads Act. There's a couple newer efforts like the Data Act and their Algorithmic Justice Act that I think are trying to get to the point where we have a lot more ad transparency. I'm actually working on a technical standard with some other researchers that we're going to be publishing in the fall, because I think regulation of ad transparency, I think we're probably looking at, it will happen sometime in the next 5 years is my guess.
What's the block? Who's in the way? If you said 5 years, that's an interesting timeline. There's at least one election within that time. In fact, there are two elections within that time, two congressional elections, presidential election, untold legislative elections. Why that timeline? And what's the block right now? Is it just hard to figure out? Or is it the political will problem? And who's in the way?
So I'd say there's a couple hard problems. One, I think that there hasn't been a good proposal that everyone thinks can withstand, you know, constitutional scrutiny. There have been some attempts to mandate disclosure that I think maybe went a little too far, like the Maryland law that got struck down a couple of years ago, because it was just too broad. It didn't just target really big digital ad platforms. It would have included like little local newspapers. I think everyone is really concerned about the constitutional efforts around compelling speech. So there is that issue to be dealt with, although I think that is a solvable problem. The other side of this, quite frankly, is that while platforms say that they support regulation and they support some forms of ad transparency, the devil is in the details. And there are things that I and a lot of other researchers think are really, really crucial to include in any transparency effort. Probably most importantly, ad targeting data that the platforms are pretty universally opposed to making available.
And if you look at the party divide, which unfortunately feels like it predicts far too much in the area of democracy, right? It feels like, let's use another thing that's like a sport, Okay, so when the NBA Rules Committee comes down and they decide what they're going to do about the three-point line, or they decide what they're going to do about handshaking, or they decide what they're going to do about, you know, a three in the key rule, there is some degree of veil of ignorance because they don't know who's going to have the best three-point shooter 8 years from now. They don't know who's going to have the best seven-footer, you know, in several seasons. So they're like, let's just make the rules good. And they might lobby on certain things. When it comes to the rules of the game, they say, okay, let's make sure we're common about the rules. It would be really nice. And it has been my understanding, even the early days of thinking about this show, it's like, okay, well, let's just get people together who care about democracy generally. We'll find basic agreement there. But too often, the jaundiced partisan eye has cast too much of a clear perspective based, I can predict too easily how people are going to land on something based on what Fox News does or doesn't say. Is there a partisan divide? Is there a Fox News problem here? Or is everybody corrupted and or everybody just slow?
There is a partisan bent to misinformation, and that's a problem.
Yeah, it sucks.
I think what is really difficult about it is that, you know, we're computer scientists. We are nonpartisan. We really try to studiously avoid taking a political side. That's just not our job. But it is hard to ignore the fact that misinformation is not evenly distributed along partisan lines. That is a problem.
Be even more explicit. Be even more explicit.
Yes, I can easily be more explicit because of some other non-ad related research that we've done, which shows that, you know, among the like the far right of the media ecosystem, a majority of interactions on Facebook take place with news outlets that have a reputation for misinformation. And this is just not true elsewhere on the political spectrum. This is most notably not true on the left. It's not true on the center. This is true on the right. So that is a problem.
So which is the thing that is true on the right? Just spell it out for me like I'm an idiot, which occasionally is the case.
The far right media ecosystem has a very high share of outlets that routinely spread misinformation.
This is something we struggle with. Okay. We struggle as a nation. We struggle with it in this discussion. I'm sure you struggle with it with you and your board of directors and how you sort of think about this. Because on one hand, we want to say it's a nonpartisan organization. Our mission is just to make sure there's more truth in the universe and more truth online and there's not misinformation. That's what we want to do. And in order to do that, you have to say, be as explicit as you just were, which is, by the way, there's a really big problem with the right-wing media ecosystem vis-a-vis misinformation. You already friends with Yochai Benkler? Have you read?
It's amazing, isn't it? Network
good
propaganda.
Stuff. It's great, right? It's great. People can check out our interview with Yochai Benkler, and it's one of my favorites. And I think it's one of the most important pieces of research being done. And I could say how I met him was actually at my law school reunion, right? He was presenting to the, he's at Harvard and he was presenting plug. And he was there presenting to, you know, like former students in a range of ages. And it was riveting. And I could tell he was trying very, very, very hard to be nonpartisan. With his material, with his data, it is impossible not to say something very much like you just said, right? I mean, that's what's going on. But as soon as you then say what the data shows, then somebody can then say, oh, well, you can't trust blank because they have come out and said that the far-right media is bad. Therefore, far-right media, you don't like them. Go ahead and tell everybody that they're liars, that they are themselves the purveyors of misinformation. How do we feel free to spell that out better than I just did? Am I just whistling Dixie? Am I the only one who sees this challenge?
No, it's a hard problem. You know, I think we think about it a lot and we try to deal with it in a couple of ways. First, look, I have to be a scientist about this. And that means that when I'm talking about the distribution of misinformation, I have to say what I just said, that the right-wing media ecosystem has a much bigger share of outlets with a reputation for misinformation than any other part of the overall media ecosystem. That's just true. And I can't shy away from saying that. That said, this gets into where the research that we've done recently differs a little bit from what Yochai Benkler and his team have found. And some of this is a matter of focus. A lot of his research has shown basically that. But the thing is that my team really focuses on studying the platform effect. And one of the things that we've found is that platforms like Facebook, specifically Facebook, they advantage misinformation misinformation seems to outperform. So let me be really specific here about what I say. So I say it correctly, excuse me. On Facebook, sources that have a reputation for misinformation outperform sources that do not have that reputation across the partisan spectrum. The difference between the far right media ecosystem and everyone else is that the far right media ecosystem has a much higher share of outlets that spread misinformation. So the far right misinformation problem looks and is much worse than it is elsewhere in the media ecosystem, but the actual Facebook effect is fairly similar.
Okay, I want to make sure I get this. You just said a mouthful, I think. So you just said that regardless of your politics, misinformation outlets with a reputation for misinformation outperform outlets without that reputation across the political spectrum. Can you give examples?
Sure. So what gets difficult here is that there are a lot of sources with a reputation for misinformation on the far right, and only a small number, for example, in like the slightly left category. But a far left source of misinformation, at least one that has a reputation for misinformation according to our categorizations, would be a group called EcoWatch. They're a Facebook page that gets a lot of interaction. They have a reputation for misinformation according to our sources, which are NewsGuard and Media Bias Fact Check. And they also perform very well on Facebook. So what we've found are statistically significant that the advantage that sources with a misinformation have, that advantage is statistically significant. It's not noise. And this is where, you know, our focus is not just on the media ecosystem. We try to understand like what effect the platform itself has. And to us, this is, you know, if we can talk about this platform effect, we think this is the most important thing that we as computer scientists can let people know is happening. That's where, again, it allows us to talk about the problem, not strictly along partisan lines. The problem is that misinformation performs really well on Facebook. That is the problem.
Lying or the willingness to do it, the willingness to say crazy stuff to garner attention, even if that crazy stuff is untethered from the truth, that enables one to get a lot more retweets, a lot more likes. People share it because it reinforces how they want the world to look or surprises them enough that they've got to share it with someone else. The proclivity, the propensity to do that is useful on social media. And that is a cross-partisan problem. It also is true that there are more of those outlets on the far right. Am I capturing this correctly?
Exactly. That is what our research indicates.
Thank you for that. That is cogent and helpful and useful. And I think we should take that clip and like share it with other people. All right. If that's the only thing people get out of this thing, it was worth having the conversation, at least for me and hopefully for you and hopefully for some others. I ventured into some analysis, right? I ventured into some, I'd like to call it more than speculation, but of why that's the case, right? That the carnival barker who's willing to say that the large man behind the curtain is 875 pounds, even if they're 420 pounds, is more likely to be an effective carnival barker, more likely to draw attention than the person who says, well, actually, the weight of the man behind the curtain is really only 400, you know, only this. They're not the heaviest person in history. And if we are an attention economy, that attention can be untethered from the truth. And those outlets that are focused on attention more than truth, maybe presumably, not surprisingly, are better at getting attention. Is there better analysis than that? What am I being lazy about or just getting wrong?
So I think that, you know, what you're saying makes a lot of intuitive sense. Unfortunately, our research doesn't really speak to why. I really try to be careful about staying within the lines.
I appreciate your carefulness.
But I think what you're saying certainly makes a lot of intuitive sense and certainly would ring true to a lot of people. I think what's really difficult here is that platforms that optimize for user engagement will get that. They will get user engagement. Then we have to ask the question, what happens when user engagement and user trust don't align? There is absolutely content that is engaging that won't necessarily make a user trust a platform more. So the question that platforms have to ask themselves is which of those two things do they prioritize when they are in conflict? And this is where I think we, as in the cybersecurity realm, need to step in and say, okay, here are some responsible guidelines for how you as a digital platform can take steps to ensure user trust.
So I'm fascinated. Lots of things occur to me. One is, what, you know, a lot of it gets to, maybe I jumped too quickly to, what are we going to do about it? And there's probably more of the problem to analyze, but the, in terms of what we do about it, I don't know. It occurs to me more consumer reports and Yelp. It occurs to me more awareness for the kind of work that you do and the sources that you use to evaluate media outlets. So at least, like, you know, if one of my cousins who is so sure that they understand, I don't know, climate science and China's role with vaccines, even though they themselves haven't completed a science course beyond, I don't know, sophomore year biology, that if they share something, then some people go, oh, by the way, these folks get a score of 7 out of 100 on the reputation, thing. That could be useful. That stuff has got to be existing. But some of the things I thought should exist didn't. Like, I thought there ought to be an easy tracker of what, like, whatever Russian bots, like confirmed, you know, sort of, you know, Russian and Eastern European trolls were like promoting. I should be able to see a list of like, okay, here are their top 10 things. Like, here are the top 10 things they're boosting and like share that. I couldn't find that anywhere. And I asked a buddy of mine who like worked for a major advocacy organization, and this guy knows as much as anybody, and he didn't know of anything either. And I was like, well, maybe somebody ought to build it. What is there? What is my, what's the best consumer reports that's the fastest? What's my PolitiFact for longitudinal treatment of truth by news agencies? Is it you? Is it stuff that you promote? And how do we get it bigger, if only to give you money?
So, I mean, what you're talking about is basically like, how can we have more visibility into what is actually happening in online spaces?
Right? Yeah.
This is really hard. My belief is that the first step on the path to better trust of online spaces that regulation can take is to regulate more transparency. So the thing we've been really public about that we talk about a lot right now is digital ad transparency, because I think this is one thing where we think we have a proposal that could be executed right now and would work. I think what you're talking about would really require Section 230 reform, because what you're saying is you want platforms to be a lot more public about what goes on in their public spaces. You want them to be more public about how they enforce, you know, their own policies. By the way, there's an interesting bill going through the California State House and Senate about this that would require more disclosure of policies and enforcement actions. And these are things that platforms are not going to do voluntarily, because you have to remember, every social media company, their customers are their advertisers, their users are their product. So every time we ask them to be more transparent about how their platforms function, about, you know, how adversaries try to take advantage of those systems, we're asking them to give away some of their market power. They really have no reason at all to do this absent regulation. And this is where I think that the first step toward that path of a better, safer internet is just regulating a lot more transparency. I think more transparency of policies, enforcement actions, and actions toward users is a really, really important step. But I think we also just need a lot more transparency about public content on social media platforms. I think that is the only way we're going to get to a place where some of the things you're talking about like, what is Russia pushing this week? You know, yeah. What is China and Iran pushing this
week? Wouldn't you be fascinated? I'd be fascinated by that.
I think it would be something that's really useful, because I think the other piece of this,
and really interesting. I think it'd just be really interesting. Maybe that'd be my favorite reading list, is like, whatever Russia's pushing, I want to know what that stuff is. Cause that itself is interesting. I have my own Twitter list that's like Russian voices, like folks have been confirmed to like be affiliated with. And I just sort of track their stuff, and it's interesting. I don't track it because I nod and retweet. I track it so that I can, I don't know, be aware of efforts at manipulation.
I think the other piece of this that really is why we just need a lot more public transparency is that at this point, a lot of these disinformation efforts, whether they're from foreign state actors or domestic ones, they're cross-platform. Individual platforms just don't have total visibility into how adversarial actors are trying to manipulate users. And this is where a lot more data sharing and data sharing with the public is what is needed, so that people can have a little bit more trust, and journalists, researchers like me, and just the general public can get a better sense of what is going on.
My consumer reports example. So there was not federal legislation that said, okay, Consumer Reports, thou shalt rate like what the best lawnmowers are and which last longer than, you know, 32 days. And Consumer Reports is able to do that. However, Consumer Reports doesn't know all the ingredients in Lucky Charms. So there's got to be an expectation. There's got to be regulations. You got to put the Lucky Charms ingredients on Lucky Charms. You know, you can't just say fortified with vitamins and then plus like go get diabetes. You know, you got to actually like know what's going on. And so my question was, what could be done as a Consumer Reports? What could be done just by what is publicly available? Here's the misinformation stuff. How do we get those profiles be more retweeted to be able to make sure that maybe outlets on more people's feeds get sort of a jaundiced color, you know, get sort of a, you know, it's like, oh, they're grayed out a little bit if they're the liar sites and you've got like win more, you know, and you download it. It's sort of a private sector solution or a nonprofit solution that we all sort of jump onto. And there might be stuff there, but your response is, yeah, but for some of that stuff, Facebook and Twitter, et cetera, have to share the information about what's going on.
Yeah. And I do want to give at least some credit here. I think the platforms are starting to be a little bit more transparent. The two that come to mind are, as much as I sort of was earlier dinging the voluntary transparency efforts from a lot of platforms, Snapchat actually has a great political ad library that is really comprehensive and has a lot of information in it. So Snapchat, I think, gets a lot of credit for being a small platform.
Snapchat's doing better.
Yes, yeah, Snapchat is doing great on the political ad transparency front.
All right.
Thanks, Snapchat.
The
other platform, I also do want to give credit to Facebook. Facebook is starting to be more transparent about their enforcement actions. So some of the things you're talking about, understanding when platforms take down Russian accounts, just so you can like know who not to trust.
Yeah.
Facebook is starting to release more reports about how they are enforcing against these particularly foreign state actors. I think that one of the problems with any voluntary effort like this is we just don't know how selective this reporting is, if this represents everything they actually find or not, but it is a step in the right direction. It is a step that I wish more platforms would take, but it's these half measures are just never going to get us there because again, it's really difficult to understand, well, was this actor only acting on Facebook and they just didn't get caught on YouTube? Or were they only on Facebook to begin with? These are kind of questions that without big systematic change, we're not going to deeply understand.
What are some of the most nefarious? Give us another sort of nefarious example, the stuff you've tracked, something that would blow people's hair back, something that would make, you know, people feel embarrassed for our democracy that you've been paying attention to.
I would say the ad campaign in April and May on Facebook to discourage African-American voters from trusting mail-in balloting. That one was pretty bad. They were running ads in like the upper Midwest that, from what I could tell, were targeting African-American Facebook users and telling them that if they used mail-in balloting, that their vote would not be counted.
You found this out just because you saw the ads or someone reported it to you? And what'd you do about it?
We reported to Facebook. Facebook actioned these. Facebook took these down. You know, some of them were using, this actually made it into the news cycle because they were using LeBron James's picture in some of these ads. They were really egregious. I think one of the things though that this pointed to me is this was just the very beginning of a long chain of Facebook ads and a lot of other things on Facebook in organic and frankly, things that, you know, the president of the United States was saying that there was going to be widespread fraud in mail-in balloting. And one of the things that to me doesn't get enough notice is the fact that this was a mass domestic disinformation campaign that worked, right? This was executed by a lot of different disparate actors who were interested in discrediting the outcome. It started pretty early in the election cycle. It started really back in April. And it worked. We are through the other side of this election, and there are millions and millions of Americans who think the election was stolen by mail-in balloting. That's pretty terrible and a pretty serious failure.
One of the challenges of regulating elections is that so much of the worst conduct happens at the very end. Just the timeline for enforcement is hard. Catch somebody doing the wrong thing. By the time you've gotten the ad taken down, a lot of the damage was done. The election might even be over. If you violate campaign finance disclosure laws, do something else, like the penalty happens after the election, well, maybe you've already won and you kind of don't care. And the teeth on the enforcement very often are limited to the four walls of the election itself. In terms of enforcement, in terms of punishment, in terms of making sure that people who do wrong actually have an incentive not to do wrong, what do you do about that?
That's a really good question. To me, I think that one of the things, at least in the online space, which is really all I can speak to here, is that a lot of the basic policies are good. Every major digital ad platform has a policy that says you're not supposed to lie in ads to users. And like, okay, there's like an asterisk if you're a politician, but we can sort that one out. The problem is that even this idea, let's just say that you had an advertiser who was running ads, and let's say you were being really good about pulling down every single one that was reported as being false. At a certain point, platforms need to recognize that a particular advertiser who's violating their policy is a bad actor, and they need to stop taking that advertiser's money. That's just an enforcement decision, right? And I think this is where probably Section 230 regulation might come into play, because right now platforms don't have a strong incentive to act against advertisers who are adversarial to users. Because let's say we have an advertiser who routinely runs ads that have fake information to them. That's obviously harmful to users because they're lying to users, but it's not harmful to the platform because they're paying the platform. So this is just like a hard business problem that probably will require regulation to fix, is my guess.
Because again, the user is not the customer. I am the product. So as long as they can keep me around, unless there's sort of a collective action problem for me trying to shift on, because you know I still want to see my cousin's baby pictures. So then I stay on to see their baby pictures. I don't want to kick them off. I don't want to stop following them. And then so I still see the misinformation on their feeds. It's like patently, abjectly false, but I still want to see their baby pictures because I, you know, love them.
And to be clear, I don't want to say
you're not mad at my cousins. I've never met them.
I also think that there are, you know, I think if Facebook or Google could wave a magic wand and take all of the misinformation off their platform, they would. I think that this is a hard business problem for them because there are people inside all of these companies who want to preserve user trust. And there are other people who want to sell ads. Yep. And that's just a hard business conflict. And, I don't think it's malicious. I think it's a bad system.
What's Facebook doing to prevent this happening in the next election? Anything they're doing? Anything they're stepping up? Because again, it's sort of like the problem, right? Like we got all frustrated about what just happened, and then we kind of forget, things move on, and then it's the next election, we get frustrated right after. But so the run up is probably more important, right?
Yes. So I have no special knowledge of Facebook, but Facebook has announced that they are making several improvements to enforcement. They have also announced that they are going to start actioning more against advertisers who persistently run problematic ads. And I think both of those are good steps forward. I think the real change that we need to see and that I'm hoping we see is just a change of mindset. I think that, we can't just continue to play whack-a-mole. And that's kind of been the MO from Facebook in the past of, they patch literally the one hole that came up last time. But what we really need is a change of mindset where Facebook and other advertising platforms start prioritizing user trust a little bit more, potentially above monetization even in some cases. And I think that's going to be hard, but that's kind of what we need to see.
When it comes to regulation, it makes us think about the Supreme Court and the impact they just had, the decision they just came down with on California's nonprofit transparency law. Is there and you can go into that if you want to, but is there a fear that there is a current mood among a majority of the Supreme Court that lying itself, the misinformation itself, that secrecy and manipulation itself, that misleading people and twisting facts itself is one manifestation, one interpretation of a fundamentalist view of free speech?
So there are constitutional issues that we're concerned about that we think are important to be mindful of. But the disclosure itself, we think, is not necessarily the constitutional problem. Because one thing that we think that does hold pretty well up to constitutional scrutiny, very specifically, disclosure of advertising and who is paying for advertising to end users. The issue in California with disclosure of funders of nonprofits is kind of like one step back and is, I think, a much murkier one. I think the constitutional issue that everyone is concerned about around ad disclosure and ad transparency is the fact that it is compelled speech. And compelled speech does need to meet a high bar of being, you know, attempting to solve a problem that is pressing and being narrowly targeted. So that's where we think we need to be really careful about making sure that we draw a line from this is the problem we're trying to solve. And that's why this universal ad transparency is the right solution. And also trying to make sure that we target the, you know, the actors that we think are really the source of the problem. That's what we're trying to do.
What's the thing that's giving you the most hope these days?
So I think the thing that is giving me the most hope these days is, well, maybe two things. I think that we are at the point where, you know, Facebook is running all of these ads around that it's time for updated regulation. And there's, at this point, 4 or 5 bills moving through the U.S. House and some bills in state houses that I think would really change the status quo. And what all this says to me, that's to me where that 5-year estimate comes from. I really think we have crossed this threshold where better regulation is inevitable. Mm-hmm. And it's just a matter of what does that actually look like? And that gives me a lot of hope.
You think the Facebook call is legit or it's more of just smokescreen, or it's more like they want to push a piece of legislation that's less damaging and more advantageous to them, either to keep out competitors because if it's hard to follow, they're the only folks who can follow it, or because it only limits stuff that they're not really worried about anyway. How skeptical should people be about Facebook's call for regulation?
I think that Facebook's call for regulation is an acknowledgement that it's inevitable. And they might as well be part of the conversation around crafting what that looks like. And I think they're not wrong. You know, I think that they do have a lot of advantages over other ad platforms in the sense that they just have a tremendous degree of scale that would help them fly with any new regulation. And I think honestly, they want to be in the room when it gets drafted because there are things that they don't want in, you know, to be made transparent.
We saw the same thing with at a different scale with campaign finance reform in our state, where some of the most powerful organizations started to get on board with at least nominally and even in one bill around campaign finance reform because constructive engagement seemed like the way to, you know, to still sort of preserve their power analysis. This is Democracy Nerd, so we should get a little nerdy on the policy itself. What are the core elements of regulation that you propose or new legislation that you support? And that does that in fact include a new agency? And if it does include a new agency, what is it? So it's not just like the FTC or the FCC, but, you know, some other new agency focused on regulating digital platforms. What should and or do you even predict they would do?
So right now, the major proposal that we are pushing is universal ad transparency.
Yep.
The standard that we're going to be proposing in the fall would put this responsibility under the FTC. You know, we think that this slots in neatly with their existing responsibilities, and some of the existing models from the FEC making data publicly available are a nice model to follow. The other things that we're talking about that would likely involve Section 230 reform, we don't have a single concrete policy around this yet. It's something we're working on. But in general, the approach that we are following, that we are trying to detail, is mostly around transparency. We really think that right now, that's the most important step that we need to take in terms of whether that transparency is done under a new agency or an existing one. I have to say, I don't quite yet see a compelling reason for there to be a whole new agency.
You think the FTC could do it?
Yes.
To be frank, yes. New department, yeah. And to identify harmful content, to figure out the code setting needed to happen, create behavioral standards, maybe build algorithms to curate content, maybe mitigate that harmful content, require it to be an editorial responsibility. What other key things, knock away any of those that you choose, what are other key things that you think that, you know, division of the FTC, say, would need to do?
So for me, like the real pillar here that we're going after is improving user trust in the public square. Online platforms are the public square, then users need to be able to trust what their interactions in that public square are like. So I think one of the pieces, maybe you said it, but it was a fast list, would be the users.
It was written down for me before this started. So it was really easy for me to start, you know, do it really fast because I can read fast. I mean, I think I could read fast at least.
Well, I think that users need to be able to understand their own public interactions. So if users are actioned against, they need to be able to understand why that happened. If a content that user has seen has been taken down, found to be fraudulent, they need to be notified of that. I think there's this like user visibility piece that almost certainly needs to happen. And it's entirely possible that all of that should be happening through the platform that, you know, on which they saw the content, but it probably needs to be some kind of mandate.
Did Facebook, just before the election in 2020, send NYU a cease and desist order to end the Ad Observer project?
Yes.
What the heck? This seems to be a little different of an interaction with the inevitability, with the rising awareness of the importance to regulate this stuff, for them to, on one hand, be sending these ads, and the other hand, be trying to knock you down. What was that all about?
So this is a little bit difficult for me to talk about because it is an ongoing matter, but yeah.
We'll just whisper it and then I'll say it loud.
A couple of weeks before the election, we received a cease and desist from Facebook. We continue to hope to come to an amicable agreement with them. But in general, we are cybersecurity researchers. We study the online space and we verify that they are safe. And you don't get to pick who studies you in this space. So we're not going to stop doing our research.
As I understand it, they claimed that that AdObserver violates user privacy, but you don't collect personal information. Is that fair to say?
That's correct. I think at this point, their claim is that we violate advertiser privacy.
Aha. And which of course sounds, is that the 11th Amendment? I forget which, I think privacy of advertising. I forget which, where that was in the Bill of Rights, but I sometimes forget. But it sounds like, I'll say it, that you revealed some flaws about their transparency policy. So they don't have political ads, unlike Snapchat. They don't include their political ads in their ad library. Is that true?
Could you say that one more time?
Does Facebook include their political ads in the Facebook ad library?
Facebook does include political ads that they identify. The problem is they don't always identify these perfectly.
Got it. What about the information they share on how much is spent on political ads? Is that pretty transparent? Is that clear? Is that consistent?
This gets a little tricky. Facebook publishes data within a range of spending on this ad was between $100 and $500. It was just below $100. This gets a little difficult because, for example, those two bands I just said sound entirely reasonable. The problem is the majority of ads in the Facebook ad library have less than $100 of spend. So all you know is less than $100. It gets very difficult to do on a high level understanding, like how much an advertiser spent on a particular campaign, because you just have a zero for every ad. And this is one of those things that like—
And say more about that. Is that just because each of them, is that because it's each of my cousins buying a couple of ads, or is this because a major player is making these micro campaigns and each one of them is worth $90?
That one. So you know how what I was saying earlier about how advertisers make many, many copies of an ad, they make—
Now I understand.
Yeah.
Now I understand. So I make an ad, but then the ad, like I make an ad, like I make a video and I make that video, but then I have the person in the room, you know, with their little mouse go and say, okay, I'm going to put this one in Arkansas focused on people who like trucks and Oprah Winfrey, and they're going to, and who are under the age of 94, over the age of 67. And there's $85 worth of them click. And I'm going to go and I'm going to do the same thing, but these are people who like Dodge over Chevy. And these are people that like, who used to like Newhart, and and people age 65, as old as 65 and older than 47. And there's $92 worth of them. Same ad, but different ad, click. Now I understand. Now exactly. I understand. Thank you. All right. So now, good luck with that. I suspect Facebook pays their fair share of lawyers.
I suspect you are right.
What didn't I ask you that I should have?
I can't think of anything. It was a really—
What about international stuff? It's fun for us too. Forgive my interruption. In particular, when you were saying something so nice. What about international standards? Is that making it easier for you because the EU is having standards we're going to have to do it for— it's sort of like California emissions in cars, right? Well, we've already going to have to do this for California. It's not as hard to do it for the rest of the country as it would be otherwise. They'll still resist it maybe a little differently. Do things happening elsewhere internationally help you or just make it more confusing?
So definitely there is a, you know, an issue about fragmentation between countries, but in general, what is going on in the EU is very helpful. I think in Europe, there is a really strong concern for user privacy. You know, we see this playing out with the DSA, the Digital Services Act. And this is why we think it's sort of a battle on many fronts. And the platforms understand that too.
Well, appreciate it very much. I want to say thank you so much to our guests for your work and what you do. Why don't you plug it? Laura Edelson, Director of Cybersecurity and Democracy. Any final plug you want to offer?
If you feel like helping out our work, you can go to adobserver.org, download our browser extension and help us collect Facebook and YouTube political ads, or just go to adobservatory.org to see data about political ads from other people.
Adobservatory.org, and then go on social media at adobserver?
Adobserver.org, yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Democracy Nerds, recorded in sunny Portland, Oregon, produced by Kyle Curtis. Thanks also to technical producer Sig Seeliger. Logo designed by Kat Buckley at kbuckleygraphics.com. I am Jefferson Smith. Thank you so much for listening. You can rate and review. Hope you will. And follow Democracy Nerd on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Past episodes of the show, Democracy Nerd, can be found online at democracynerd.us. Go America. Thank you. Thank you, Democracy.